supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Delaware County Democrats gathered in an auditorium at Upper Darby High School this week to sort out a dilemma. The party has to decide who to endorse for Congress, and there are 14 candidates on the primary ballot seeking their support. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
This debate wasn't just for voters that happened to show up. It was open to the public, but it was organized for the 800-plus members of the Delaware County Democratic Committee who'd like to unite around a candidate and have to somehow sort this thing out.
You know, it's hard enough to go to the supermarket and make decisions of what kind of milk you want, but when you have 14 people, and for the most part, they all sound very good and convincing, it's hard.
That's Penny McDonald, chair of the Yadin Borough Democratic Party. There's another reason, apart from the sprawling field of candidates, that this is a special moment for the Delaware County Party.
We have had no Democratic power forever.
That's Rachel Amder of Havertown, acknowledging the fact that for decades the party was a battered, impotent minority in a county ruled by a powerful Republican machine. But demographics and political currents have shifted, and Democrats are now winning township and countywide elections. Why are there so many congressional candidates? Several emerged last year, inspired in part by the election of Donald Trump. Then incumbent Republican Congressman Pat Meehan dropped out of the race after it came to light he'd settled a sexual harassment lawsuit with a former employee. That encouraged more to enter the race. Finally, the state Supreme Court created a new congressional district, giving Democrats a heavy advantage in the general election. Committeewoman Natalie Jordan says it's a big opportunity, and party leaders like her have a big responsibility.
It really highlights the job that committees do here in Delaware County, because a lot of our constituents are going to say, well, who should I vote for? And at minimum, we should be able to at least name them all.
So who is in the field? There are 7 men and 7 women. 3 are elected officials. There are 11 whites, 2 blacks, and 1 Asian American. Many are first-time candidates. Most are little known. So they did their best with limited time at the debate to make an impression, one way or another.
I ask you for your vote as the only experienced female legislator on this stage.
I have proudly served my country for over a decade as an officer with the CIA.
My life mission has been environmental protection.
I'm also running to do something about gun violence. Sandy Hook happened on my birthday. It's become one of my greatest missions of my life to do something about this.
I'm probably the only person here who's been threatened by an NRA member.
Simply walk a mile in my shoes. Just last night, a young girl, 19 years old, lost her life to gun violence in my community.
What we really need is campaign finance reform, and I'm for a voucher system where every single American can contribute the same amount to congressional campaigns.
I joined the Peace Corps and I served in China. I went to Harvard Law School on 100% financial aid because my family and I, of course, couldn't afford those huge tuition bills.
That was Margo Davidson, Shelley Chauncey, Greg Vitale, Lindy Lee, Dan Muroff, Thaddeus Kirkland, Molly Sheehan, and David Wertheim. As noted, a lot of people. Also in the race are Mary Gay Scanlon, Larry Arata, George Beatty, Ashley Lunkenheimer, Teresa Wright, and Rich Laser, a candidate who poses a tricky issue for these Delaware County Democrats. Many want someone from the county to get the congressional seat, but Laser is from the small portion of South Philadelphia that's in the district and comes with powerful backing in the building trades unions. They're expected to spend a lot of money on an independent ad campaign on his behalf. Committeewoman Rachel Amder doesn't want a congressman to get into office with big spending from a super PAC.
Because he now owes the person who funded him. He has somebody behind him saying, I paid you. I did this for you. I paid it. So for me, that's a big detraction from him, regardless of where he lives.
Hundreds of party committee members will gather Sunday evening to consider an endorsement. Under party rules, that would require the votes of 55% of those present, a tall order with 14 candidates in the field. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump reportedly feels increasingly emboldened to act upon his priorities, and he cites rising poll numbers of late to substantiate acting on his instincts. Let's look at the numbers with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Are these Gallup numbers that the president's looking at?
No, they're not. And he's overlooking at the numbers he is looking at. A couple of points. One is he typically refers to, in his tweets and otherwise, a Rasmussen poll, which we can talk about, which typically runs up to 10 points higher than the average of all other polls. And second, when people come out with polls, occasionally they'll be up a couple of points from the last time they took a poll, as was the case for CNN not too long ago. And he and others leap on that and say, look, my approval rating's going up. But when we at Gallup look at our long-term trends and when we look at the averages of other polls over time, we really don't see any change at all in the Americans' approval of the job Trump is doing as president.
How might they contrast with President Obama's numbers in March of his term?
Yeah, that was interesting because President Trump tweeted out one Rasmussen poll that had him up at 51%, and then he compared it to an Obama number and said, look, I'm doing better than Obama. That's not the case. In our Gallup poll for all of March back in 2010, which would have been the comparable time in Obama's first term, Obama had an overall job approval rating of 49%. And for all of March this year, Trump's job approval rating is 39%. So he's running about 10 points behind Barack Obama at this time in both of their presidencies.
Frank, I'd like to take you up on it. Let's focus on that Rasmussen polling.
Yeah, it's not that they are intentionally trying to distort the numbers, but there are methodological differences which are very important for our listeners to be aware of. For one thing, they use what we call IVR polling, which is interactive voice reporting, which basically means they call listed numbers. Listed numbers is the big factor there because they tend to skew older and more likely to say they support Trump. Now, Rasmussen is aware of this, so that organization augments their polling with some online polls that they think help correct for the listed number bias. And finally, they look at likely voters, and those typically skew significantly more Republican than Democrats. So when you put all that together, you've got a poll that, as I mentioned a minute ago, typically averages up to 10 points higher than the average of most other polls which ask about Donald Trump.
Frank, lastly, let's take up the teaching profession. Very sobering to learn that around a quarter of teachers wish they'd chosen another profession. Why?
Absolutely. 25% of teachers say they wish they had not gone into teaching as a profession. And we have data in the same survey of teachers, which gives us a clue as to why. We asked teachers, how much influence do each of the following have on decisions that are made at your school? And teachers agree that the school administration and school board have a lot of influence, but they, beyond that, say it's the state government and then the federal government that have a great deal of influence, and they put themselves, teachers, below all of the above. And they put parents even below that. Then we turned around and said, all right, how much influence should these entities have on decisions at your school? And teachers put themselves absolutely at the top. So in other words, teachers say we don't have any input now, relatively speaking, or little input. We should have a great deal more input.
If the teachers had more control, would they perhaps wish that students spent less time in front of their screens?
Mixed bag. They actually think that screens can be good for education. And I'm supposing they're saying here, well, maybe iPads in the classroom and some things like that could be good. But when we ask teachers, are kids looking at their phones and iPads and all that good for their, that is, the students' mental health and their physical health, teachers fairly strongly say, no, we think they're harmful to students.
As you cite mental and physical health, I'm wondering if perhaps school shootings is also a factor making teachers reconsider their profession.
It's possible. We asked that question as well in our recent poll, and 22% of teachers said that they have reconsidered teaching, or they're more worried at any rate because of the safety concerns at their school. So that's a factor as well, I'm sure, in some teachers' concern right now about their profession.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. In the pantheon of modern classical music, Karlheinz Stockhausen looms large with a career that spans six decades and included orchestral and chamber works, electronic music, and opera. And many were large scale as well. WHYY's Kimberly Haas reports on the Philadelphia premiere of the composer's final work that takes 14 hours to perform.
Contemporary classical music often has the reputation of being challenging to listen to and understand. Experiments in tonality, unusual instruments, and sometimes the sheer scale of a work can drive performers and audiences back to familiar pieces. But Philadelphia-based harpist Elizabeth Houston felt a different urge when choosing her latest project.
I was just mostly looking for these large-scale pieces that really don't get ever performed all together, and I wanted to create an environment where I could have all of these pieces performed.
This weekend, Houston and 30 musicians will present Klang, the last work by German composer Karlheinz Stockhausen. It's a cycle of chamber works, one representing each hour of the day. But he died in 2007 before completing the set. The existing 21 sections make up a 14-hour performance.
And he was obsessed by time and the concept of time.
Trumpeter Marco Blau is a member of Ensemble Musique Fabrique, who worked for Stockhausen for many years. He says Klang is the culmination of the composer's study of the way different cultures and different eras viewed the idea of time.
How do we perceive time? How do we live time? And he composed Yaroslav, so he was very, very occupied with the year, the concept of a year. And then the month in Tierkreis, the zodiac. And then obviously the week was next, and that was the opera cycle. I think it's 32 hours of music. And then he started composing the day, divided up in 24 hours.
I spoke with Stockhausen in 1982 for the documentary series Totally Wired. He explained his plans for expressing his concepts of time through music.
It's a permanent attempt in my work to push the limits further out, in particular in time. I want to concentrate on the day, and then on the hour, and then on the minute, and then on the second. Once I die, I'm sure I will discover that a second is an eternity, and that there is a lot going on in a second. I mean, the quickness of a thought, and the time unit of my alpha waves, or of my brain, are far smaller than the second. To amplify this, and to enlarge it, to stretch it, because I think the miracles are within this microtime.
Stockhausen had the reputation of being an intense personality with strong opinions to go along with his big musical concepts. Chester County-based pianist Ron Thomas studied with Stockhausen when the composer was a visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the 1960s.
And it was just delightful to see how he brought his own compositions. We analyzed them. We talked about them. It was artistic and academic, and he was very generous with what he shared about how he worked out his thesis. And, of course, he did have a huge ego. He was a German intellectual. When I was with him, he was the extension of Schoenberg and Weber. He was the next step.
Marco Blau thinks Stockhausen's personality comes through in the music.
He works with a very strict, systematic way of working. And at the same time, he puts a lot of poetry in the music and the way he shapes the phrasing, almost a romantic back to the 19th century music. The way he talked about it, it's almost back to Brahms. So it's very contemporary, surrealistic music combined with a romantic heart.
Harpist Elizabeth Houston feels there's another component that makes Klang inviting to new audiences.
One thing that has really drawn me to Stockhausen's music is how visual it is. When you're, you know, playing these high notes, he writes that you are supposed to raise your clarinet. He writes that you're supposed to spin while you're playing. All of the pieces have been assigned a color that you're supposed to either project or display, or the performers are supposed to wear the color. It's really a visual extravaganza. And I think this idea that music can be multidisciplinary, that it's not just theater and dance that can have sets.
But there's still the issue of how to approach 14 hours of music.
We have really made this event designed around the idea that sitting in a chair and listening to music for 14 hours is an impossibility. And so the beginning of the event, people are free to walk around on the stage. They can sit on the stage during the piano piece. The pianist is very interested in people laying under the piano. And then we are actually putting pieces from Klang that were inspired by each other. We're putting them in parallel rooms so you can listen to the parallel themes. And so really it's kind of dependent on what experience you want to create.
Audiences can create their experience with Karlheinz Stockhausen's Klang at Fringe Arts with two performances on Saturday and Sunday. Kimberly Haas, WHYY News.
A Syrian hip-hop artist will perform this weekend in Philadelphia. Omar Effendim was born in Saudi Arabia, raised in Washington, D.C., and is now based in Los Angeles. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that he's bridging classical Arabic poetry with rap.
Is it a clack or is it a bomb? Is it a poem or is it a song?
Omar Effendim has spent this week in Philadelphia talking and rapping to students at Bodine High School. He's trying to teach them that Arabic poetry and rap are really not so different. Rap music is often laced with references to Islam, and Philadelphia's urban culture in particular is permeated with Arabic. Effendim discovered this while riding a SEPTA bus. The driver was wearing a hijab, so he greeted her in Arabic, assalamu alaikum, and she responded with the same.
She responded so casually and so nonchalantly that it was just kind of like an everyday thing. She didn't even think twice about it. Whereas, like, in Los Angeles, if I see somebody wearing a hijab and I say, assalamu alaikum, there's a moment there where it's like, oh, okay, we're minorities here, and this is, like, a special moment that we're sharing. In Philadelphia, it's just another person you're saying hello to.
In his songs and poetry, Effendim likes to blend English and Arabic fluidly. He has translated classical Arabic poetry into English, for example, the work by Syria's best-known poet, Nazir Kobani, and vice versa. He has translated a Langston Hughes poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, into Arabic.
And that poem in particular is really powerful because he references the Euphrates and the Nile, talking about these rivers, these freshwater sources of life that are a basic fundamental thing that all human beings share. You know, he's able to frame that notion of a common humanity that binds us all in a very beautiful poetic way.
Effendim normally raps over programmed beats, but for his performance at the International House in Philadelphia this Sunday, he will be backed up by a local trio of stand-up bass, Latin percussion, and the oud, a stringed Arabic instrument similar to a lute. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
By a few hours, let's get a jump on tomorrow's National Beer Day celebrations. Joining me with the long view is Pennsylvania brewery historian Rich Wagner. Rich, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Let's get into Pennsylvania's role, but first, what does National Beer Day actually celebrate?
It celebrates the return of beer after a 13-year-long prohibition.
So prohibition was starting in 1920?
20 to 1933. So on April 7th, the floodgates opened and people could drink legal beer again.
But of course, to take the long view, we have to go long before 1920 when evaluating Pennsylvania's role in all things suds.
Well, historically, Pennsylvania has always been in the top three in the country as far as either the number of breweries or the amount of beer produced. So usually New York was ahead, but then you had Pennsylvania and Wisconsin usually competing for second and third place.
When was the first heyday of breweries in Pennsylvania?
Well, in Philadelphia, first 1685. That was our first brewery in Philadelphia. With the introduction of lager beer in Philadelphia in 1840, that basically caught on beyond the ethnic German population and became what was considered a national beverage. Light lager beer was the thing that grew the industry in the United States and in the world.
What style or styles of beer did lager replace?
Well, the bottom fermented ales of the English style of beer. Of course, we were a British colony, so we had the customs and the tavern culture from England and as well as other places around the world all transplanted here. But when lager beer yeast, which was a bottom fermenting yeast, and it fermented in the cold and you needed to age the beer for a much longer period, you got a much finer product. It was a refined beverage. And so this is what really made it catch on, because it was light and it was refreshing and it was cold.
At its height, how many brew pubs and breweries were there in the vicinity, and what caused the decline?
With the growth of lager beer, you had a lot of the lager beer saloons where they would actually make it on site, and it was just like a tavern or a saloon in the block among the houses. And then the larger companies came to predominate because they had economies of scale and they could, you know, invest in large tracts of real estate, build huge buildings, and take the production figures up to the, you know, quarter of a million barrels, let's say. And that was in the late 1800s. So when Prohibition arrived, we had about 40 breweries operating in the city of Philadelphia.
When you first did your study of the area, I believe around 1980, that was reduced to nine.
There were nine in the state. And it was just a matter of conjecture which one was going to be the next to go. And we were just waiting for all the dominoes to fall.
Is there a single person or an event that you can point to that launched, as it were, the renaissance in craft beer?
Well, if you really want to take it to one person. It's Jimmy Carter, who made homebrewing legal. By legalizing homebrewing, you started to have homebrew shops, and you had started people communicating and people saying, look at this beer we bought from England or Germany or some other place around the world. We could make that style 5 gallons at a time. And it was fun, and people really started to have a good time with it. And, of course, then you had people that said, let's try to do this for real, or let's do this for real. And some of these people that had started out making, stuff on their stove ended up being some of the brewers that are in the top 20 producers in the country today.
How did you first get into this?
In 1980, a friend and I and our girlfriends went driving around Pennsylvania, and we went to go to all the tasting rooms of all the breweries in the state, and we made it to about 6. When we got done, we found this book that listed where all the breweries in the country had been. So I circled all the towns on a map of Pennsylvania, and I said to my friend, we ought to go to every one of these towns and see if there's anything still standing of these breweries. We ran around to all these towns, photographing walls, some cases like a piece of a foundation or a stone that was part of the well or whatever, and all the way to watching them take some of these derelict buildings and turn them into beautiful, you know, repurposed structures, like the Stegmeyer Brewery up in Wilkes-Barre has been converted into a post office and federal office buildings and so forth. So I've seen a lot of this, not just the new breweries open, but some of the breweries that I thought would just crumble into the dirt have been turned into, in some cases, breweries again, and in other cases, just repurposed for other needs.
What's ahead for you in terms of research or passion? At this juncture, you've been to now some 800 breweries, I understand.
I still do my colonial brewing demonstration, and so that season is coming up in the spring and in the fall. We do a lot of brewing over an open fire at these historic sites and at beer festivals and so forth. So that's what's in my horizon.
I understand in the short term, the focus will be on Northern Liberties next month.
Oh, at the German Society. Yes, I'm giving a talk on Northern Liberties. When I added them up, there were either 99 or 103 breweries that have ever been in Northern Liberties throughout history.
So that's the derivation of the song, 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall.
Could be.
Rich, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks
you.
Tonight. Pennsylvania brewery historian Rich Wagner. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.